Chapter 26. The Romans at Mr. Jacob's Academy, his knowledge was strictly correct, but it went no farther than the fact that they were in the New Testament, and Mr. Stelling was not the man to enfeeble and emasculate his pupil's mind by simplifying and explaining, or to reduce the tonic effect of etymology by mixing it with smattering, extraneous information, such as is given to girls. Yet, strange to say, under this vigorous treatment Tom became more like a girl than he had ever been in his life before. He had a large share of pride, which had hitherto found itself very comfortable in the world, despising old goggles, and reposing in the sense of unquestioned rights. But now this same pride met with nothing but bruises and crushings. Tom was too clear-sighted not to be aware that Mr. Stelling's standard of things was quite different, was certainly something higher in the eyes of the world than that of the people he had been living amongst, and that, brought in contact with it, he, Tom Tulliver, appeared uncouth and stupid. He was by no means indifferent to this, and his pride got into an uneasy condition which quite nullified his boyish self-satisfaction, and gave him something of the girl's susceptibility. He was a very firm, not to say obstinate, disposition, but there was no brute-like rebellion and recklessness in his nature. The human sensibilities predominated, and if it had occurred to him that he could enable himself to show some quickness at his lessons, and so acquire Mr. Stelling's approbation, by standing on one leg for an inconvenient length of time, or rapping his head moderately against the wall, or any voluntary action of that sort, he would certainly have tried it. But no. Tom had never heard that these measures would brighten the understanding, or strengthen the verbal memory, and he was not given to hypothesis and experiment. It did occur to him that he could perhaps get some help by praying for it, but as the prayers he said every evening were forms learned by heart, he rather shrank from the novelty and irregularity of introducing an extempore passage on a topic of petition for which he was not aware of any precedent. But one day, when he had broken down, for the fifth time, in the supines of the third conjugation, and Mr. Stelling, convinced that this must be carelessness, since it transcended the bounds of possible stupidity, had lectured him very seriously, pointing out that, if he failed to seize the present golden opportunity of learning supines, he would have to regret it when he became a man. Tom, more miserable than usual, determined to try his sole resource. And that evening, after his usual form of prayer for his parents and little sister, he had begun to pray for Maggie when she was a baby, and that he might be able always to keep God's commandments, he added, in the same low whisper, "And please to make me always remember my Latin." He paused a little to consider how he should pray about Euclid, whether he should ask to see what it meant, or whether there was any other mental state which would be more applicable to the case. But at last he added, "Colon and make Mr. Stelling say I shan't do Euclid anymore. Amen." The fact that he got through his supines without mistake the next day encouraged him to persevere in this appendix to his prayers, and neutralized any skepticism that might have arisen from Mr. Stelling's continued demand for Euclid. But his faith broke down under the apparent absence of all help when he got into the irregular verbs. It seemed clear that Tom's despair under the caprices of the present tense did not constitute a notice worthy of interference, and since this was the climax of his difficulties, where was the use of praying for help any longer? He made up his mind to this conclusion in one of his dull, lonely evenings, which he spent in the study, preparing his lessons for the morrow. His eyes were apt to get dim over the page, though he hated crying, and was ashamed of it. He couldn't help thinking with some affection even of Spouncer, whom he used to fight and quarrel with. He would have felt at home with Spouncer, and in a condition of superiority. And then the mill, and the river, and Yap pricking up his ears, ready to obey the least sign when Tom said, "Hoy!" would all come before him in a sort of clincher, when his fingers played absently in his pocket with his great knife and his coil of whipcord, and other relics of the past. Tom, as I said, had never been so much like a girl in his life before, and at that epoch of irregular verbs his spirit was further depressed by a new means of mental development which had been thought of for him out of school hours. Mrs. Stelling had lately had her second baby, and as nothing could be more salutary for a boy than to feel himself useful, Mrs. Stelling considered she was doing Tom a service by setting him to watch the little cherub Laura while the nurse was occupied with the sickly baby. It was quite a pretty employment for Tom to take little Laura out in the sunniest hour of the autumn day. It would help to make him feel that Lorton Parsonage was a home for him, and that he was one of the family. The little cherub Laura, not being an accomplished walker at present, had a ribbon fastened round her waist, by which Tom held her, as if he had been a little dog during the minutes in which he chose to walk. But as these were rare, he was for the most part carrying this fine child round and round the garden, within sight of Mrs. Stelling's window, according to orders. If anyone considers this unfair, and even oppressive toward Tom, I beg him to consider that there are feminine virtues which are with difficulty combined, even if they are not incompatible. When the wife of a poor curate contrives, under all her disadvantages, to dress extremely well, and to have a style of coiffure which requires that her nurse shall occasionally officiate as lady's maid, when, moreover, her dinner parties and her drawing room show that effort at elegance and completeness of appointment to which ordinary women might imagine a large income necessary, it would be unreasonable to expect of her that she should employ a second nurse, or even act as a nurse herself. Mr. Stelling knew better. He saw that his wife did wonders already, and was proud of her. It was certainly not the best thing in the world for young Tulliver's gait to carry a heavy child, but he had plenty of exercise in long walks with himself, and next half year Mr. Stelling would see about having a drilling master. Among the many means whereby Mr. Stelling intended to be more fortunate than the bulk of his fellow men, he had entirely given up that of having his own way in his own house. What then? He had married as kind a little soul as ever breathed, according to Mr. Riley, who had been acquainted with Mrs. Stelling's blonde ringlets and smiling demeanor throughout her maiden life, and on the strength of that knowledge would have been ready any day to pronounce that whatever domestic differences might arise in her married life must be entirely Mr. Stelling's fault. If Tom had had a worse disposition, he would certainly have hated the little cherub Laura, but he was too kind-hearted a lad for that. There was too much in him of the fiber that turns to true manliness, and too protecting pity for the weak. I am afraid he hated Mrs. Stelling, and contracted a lasting dislike to pale blonde ringlets and broad plates, as directly associated with haughtiness of manner, and a frequent reference to other people's beauty. But he couldn't help playing with little Laura, and liking to amuse her. He even sacrificed his percussion caps for her sake, in despair of their ever serving a greater purpose, thinking the small flash and bang would delight her, and thereby drawing down on himself a rebuke from Mrs. Stelling for teaching her child to play with fire. Laura was a sort of playfellow, and oh, how Tom longed for playfellows! In his secret heart he yearned to have Maggie with him, and was almost ready to dote on her exasperating acts of forgetfulness. Though, when he was at home, he always represented it as a great favor on his part to let Maggie trot by his side on his pleasure excursions. And before this dreary half-year was ended, Maggie actually came. Mrs. Stelling had given a general invitation for the little girl to come and stay with her brother. So when Mr. Tulliver drove over to King's Lorton late in October, Maggie came too, with the sense that she was taking a great journey and beginning to see the world. It was Mr. Tulliver's first visit to see Tom, for the lad must learn not to think too much about home. "Well, my lad," he said to Tom, when Mr. Stelling had left the room to announce the arrival to his wife, and Maggie had begun to kiss Tom freely, "you look rarely. School agrees with you. Tom wished he had looked rather ill. I don't think I am well, Father, said Tom. I wish you'd ask Mr. Stelling not to let me do Euclid. It brings on the toothache, I think. The toothache was the only malady to which Tom had ever been subject. Euclid, my lad, why, what's that? Said Mr. Tulliver. Oh, I don't know. It's definitions, and axioms, and triangles, and things. It's a book I've got to learn and there's no sense in it. Go, go, said Mr. Tulliver, reprovingly. You mustn't say so. You must learn what your master tells you. He knows what it's right for you to learn. I'll help you now, Tom, said Maggie, with a little air of patronizing consolation. I'm come to stay ever so long, if Mrs. Stelling asks me. I've brought my box and my pinafores, haven't I, Father? You help me, you silly little thing, said Tom, in such high spirits at this announcement, that he quite enjoyed the idea of confounding Maggie by showing her a page of Euclid. I should like to see you doing one of my lessons. Why, I learn Latin too. Girls never learn such things. They're too silly. I know what Latin is very well, said Maggie, confidently. Latin's a language. There are Latin words in the dictionary. There's bonus, a gift. Now, you're just wrong there, Miss Maggie, said Tom, secretly astonished. Why you think you're very wise? But bonus means good, apostrophe as it happens, bonus, bona, bonum. Well, that's no reason why it shouldn't mean gift, said Maggie, stoutly. It may mean several things. Almost every word does. There's lawn, apostrophe it means the grass plot, as well as the stuff pocket handkerchiefs are made of. Well done, little un, said Mr. Tulliver, laughing, while Tom felt rather disgusted with Maggie's knowingness, though beyond measure cheerful at the thought that she was going to stay with him. Her conceit would soon be overawed by the actual inspection of his books. Mrs. Stelling, in her pressing invitation, did not mention a longer time than a week for Maggie's stay, but Mr. Stelling, who took her between his knees and asked her where she stole her dark eyes from, insisted that she must stay a fortnight. Maggie thought Mr. Stelling was a charming man, and Mr. Tulliver was quite proud to leave his little wench, where she would have an opportunity of showing her cleverness to appreciating strangers. So it was agreed that she should not be fetched home till the end of the fortnight. Now then, come with me into the study, Maggie, said Tom, as their father drove away. W, what do you shake and toss your head now for, you silly, he continued. For though her hair was now under a new dispensation, and was brushed smoothly behind her ears, she seemed still in imagination to be tossing it out of her eyes. It makes you look as if you were crazy. Oh, I can't help it, said Maggie, impatiently. Don't tease me, Tom. Oh, what books, she exclaimed, as she saw the bookcases in the study. How I should like to have as many books as that. Why, you couldn't read one of them, said Tom, triumphantly. They're all Latin. No, they aren't, said Maggie. I can read the back of this, History of the Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire. Apostrophe, well, what does that mean? You don't know, said Tom, wagging his head. But I could soon find out, said Maggie, scornfully. Why, how? I should look inside, and see what it was about. You'd better not, Miss Maggie, said Tom, seeing her hand on the volume. Mr. Stelling lets nobody touch his books without leave, and I shall catch it, if you take it out. Oh, very well. Let me see all your books, then, said Maggie, turning to throw her arms round Tom's neck and rub his cheek with her small round nose. Tom, in the gladness of his heart at having dear old Maggie to dispute with and crow over again, seized her round the waist and began to jump with her round the large library table. Away they jumped with more and more vigor, till Maggie's hair flew from behind her ears and twirled about like an animated mop. But the revolutions round the table became more and more irregular in their sweep, Till at last reaching Mr. Stelling's reading stand, they sent it thundering down with its heavy lexicons to the floor. Happily it was the ground floor, and the study was a one-storied wing to the house, so that the downfall made no alarming resonance, though Tom stood dizzy and aghast for a few minutes, dreading the appearance of Mr. or Mrs. Stelling. "Oh, I say, Maggie," said Tom at last, lifting up the stand, "we must keep quiet here, you know. If we break anything, Mrs. Stelling'll make us cry peccavi." "What's that?" said Maggie. "Oh, it's the Latin for a good scolding," said Tom, not without some pride in his knowledge. "Is she a cross woman?" said Maggie. "I believe you," said Tom, with an emphatic nod. "I think all women are crosser than men," said Maggie. "Aunt Glegg's a great deal crosser than Uncle Glegg, and Mother scolds me more than Father does." "Well, you'll be a woman someday," said Tom, "so you needn't talk." "But I shall be a clever woman," said Maggie, with a toss. "Oh, I dare say, and a nasty conceited thing. Everybody'll hate you." "But you oughtn't to hate me, Tom. It'll be very wicked of you, for I shall be your sister." "Yes, but if you're a nasty disagreeable thing, I shall hate you." "Oh, but, Tom, you won't. I shan't be disagreeable. I shall be very good to you, and I shall be good to everybody. You won't hate me really, will you, Tom?" "Oh, bother. Never mind. Come, it's time for me to learn my lessons. See here. What I've got to do," said Tom, drawing Maggie toward him, and showing her his theorem, while she pushed her hair behind her ears, and prepared herself to prove her capability of helping him in Euclid. She began to read with full confidence in her own powers, but presently, becoming quite bewildered, her face flushed with irritation. It was unavoidable. She must confess her incompetency, and she was not fond of humiliation. "It's nonsense," she said, "and very ugly stuff. Nobody need want to make it out." "Ah, there now, Miss Maggie," said Tom, drawing the book away, and wagging his head at her, "you see you're not so clever as you thought you were." "Oh," said Maggie, pouting, "I dare say I could make it out, if I'd learned what goes before, as you have." "But that's what you just couldn't, Miss Wisdom," said Tom. "F for it's all the harder, when you know what goes before, for then you've got to say what definition 3 is, and what axiom 5 is. But get along with you now, I must go on with this. Here's the Latin grammar. See what you can make of that." Maggie found the Latin grammar quite soothing after her mathematical Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.